அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்கள் இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று மிஸ்டர் கேரி சார் அவர்கள் புக் டூவில் சாப்டர் 10 நாலேஜ் பை ஐடென்டிட்டி அண்ட் செப்பரேட்டி நாலேஜ் என்ற தலைப்பில் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி to deliver this speech.
Good morning to everyone. I'm sorry I can't be with you physically there in Mandalam today. I miss the experience of that. But I hope that Sri Aurobindo will make up for that. Because he gives us a wonderful gift in this chapter. In the earlier chapters, as you remember, he has described the nature of our ignorance to us pretty graphically, pretty clearly. Our ignorance of ourselves and our ignorance of the world. But for us, what we know seems to be pretty natural and normal. In fact, it seems to be the only way that we could know anything. We take it for granted that we're blind to the future because the future hasn't happened yet as far as we're concerned. We take it for granted that we can't relive something that happened in the past because it's over and done. That's the way we experience it. We take it as very natural that we can't see beyond our immediate environment. We don't know what's going on in the next room or the next block or the next city or around the world. That's normal for us. We take it for natural that I don't know what you're thinking in your head or what you're feeling in your heart. I can only guess by looking at your expression or thinking that I know you well. We learn from our experiences by a trial and error process, mostly by doing things, failing many times, and then learning something from that. And science has organized this as a set of experiments because they think that's the way learning should take place. It reminds me of that story that I've mentioned earlier that Mother tells in the agenda, that in one of her night experiences, she was up on the rooftop of this building and there was a street lamp, a dim street lamp shining there, and there's a man standing in front of that street lamp with his hands in front of his head. "Please turn off that light, it's too bright. It's too bright for me." Mother felt that the place is so dark and dreary, it's hard to see anything here. That street lamp is the human consciousness. The question for us is, though, is there any other way we can know? Is there really any other possibility? There's no sense us abusing ourselves or accusing ourselves if we don't think there's any other possibility. In this chapter, he tells us that what we call knowing, what we do all the time, "I want to know what you think. I want to know what's going on. I want to know what's going to happen. I want to know what's happening to me." What we call knowledge is not knowledge at all. It's ignorance. Well, that's very fine, but why does he say that's ignorance? And then what is real knowledge? He tells us the real knowing is very different from what we do normally. But we are capable of real knowing also. But our way of knowing is not normal. It's a distortion or a limitation of our real capacity for knowledge. And so he takes us on a tour. We're privileged to go on a tour of the universe of knowledge, which very few human beings have ever been on or even know about. And to me, it seems like a kind of a roller coaster ride. Some of you have been on a roller coaster. Many of you must have seen a roller coaster at least. You know, a roller coaster starts off at the ground level. And you get in this innocent-looking cart, and then you start ascending up. Eventually, you go up to the top of a high peak. And then the cart turns around and suddenly goes down a long, steep decline that takes your breath away or your stomach away, goes far down, and then it curves up again and finally arrives back at the starting place. And this is what he does for us in this chapter. He starts out at ground level, which for us is the normal human consciousness. We can call it the home station on our train journey. Like Phileas Fogg in Around the World of 80 Days, if he wants to travel around the world, he needs a Bradshaw, what they call the Bradshaw timetable, a schedule of what is the next stop and where we're going. So in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo gives us a Bradshaw for the stops and stages of consciousness that he's going to walk us through. We're starting at the home station, which is the human ignorance. And then we're going to plunge into the secret inner consciousness that's there behind and around us all the time, which he calls the subliminal, which is not other than ourself. He tells us it's really our self, our full being. And then we're going to expand out to the cosmic consciousness to be as wide as the universe. We're going to ascend from there to the superconscious, to the supermental heavens, and see what it looks like, what knowledge looks like from up there. And once we get a real idea of what true knowledge is, what he calls knowledge by identity, we're going to start the decline. We're going to come down from that peak, and we're going to come back down into the subliminal, into the cosmic consciousness, and see how they are a gradual limitation of that true way of knowing, which is the knowledge by identity. And then we're going to plunge further down, all the way into the depths of the dark inconscient, to see what happens to knowledge when we go to the nether end. And finally, he's going to return us back to where we started from. And he tells us that this journey has a name. He's taking us through the country of our spirit, of our true self. What we think is ourself, this little being caught on the surface, locked into our petty concerns, our problems, our limitations of all types, is not our being at all. It's the ego. And in order to get true knowledge, we have to come out of that. He gives us an analogy. He says, it's like we're living in a huge ocean. We're a huge being, hundreds of feet tall, and only our head is sticking out on the surface of the water, and that's the only thing we're aware of. We're living in that little thing above the surface. But our true being is not just all that's below the surface, it's the whole ocean. And not only that, it's the whole sky above. And none of that we recognize as our real being. And this is the journey he's going to take us on. We can imagine the stages of this journey, not starting from where we are, but starting from the superconscient by using the analogy that we've used in the past about Jane Austen when she writes her story. And we'll come back to it later. But Jane Austen conceiving of her story of Pride and Prejudice and all the characters and events in it is like being in the superconscient, being in the supermind. And she goes through a process of creating that story, making those characters real, giving them almost an independent existence of their own. And maybe out of her affection for one of the characters, like Elizabeth, She tries to identify with that character, and she identifies with her so much that for a few minutes she actually believes that she's Elizabeth Bennet and not Jane Austen. And that's where we are today. We are the author of a universal creation. We have created all of this. We have created our character and all the other characters who are really characters of ourselves. And now we have identified with one tiny little part of our being and think that all the rest is not self. And our journey to the spirit is to help reawaken and discover the truth. For those of you who know the story of the Wizard of Oz, the whole story takes place because Dorothy is in Kansas and she gets knocked on the head during a cyclone, and she's unconscious and she has this whole experience. And during that experience, she's anxious to wait to come back. She wants to go home. She thinks she's lost and gone into some strange other world, and she's wondering how to get home. But the real truth is all she has to do is wake up. And at the end of the story, she wakes up and finds out she's back in Kansas. Well, for us to wake up is not to end up in Kansas, it's to be back in the superconscient heavens from which we came. In this chapter, he's going to talk about four ways of knowing. And at first sight, these four ways may sound a little complicated to us, but the truth is we are using these four ways all the time. There's nothing mysterious or unknown about it, but we don't normally think about it in these terms. The normal way in which we know is, I try to know something that's separate from myself. I think everything else other than me is separate from me, and if I want to know it, what do? I use my senses. I look at it, I smell it, I touch it, I listen to it, whatever it may be. I'm trying to relate to something that's totally separate from myself, which is what we're doing all the time. But we also have a capacity to know something by a certain inner feeling. I know how he feels. That's a common expression we say. Even though he doesn't express it, I know what he's really feeling. We have a capacity for direct contact with things, with people, with other things. And we also have a capacity to identify with other things as ourself. And he calls that knowledge by identity. So he starts out by trying to illustrate for us these different ways of knowing in our own surface consciousness. And he tells us that as we live today, there's only one thing we can really know by identity. If you close your eyes and want to know whether you exist, you don't have to think about it. You don't have to consult anybody. You don't need to touch yourself. You don't need to listen to your voice. You don't need to watch your thoughts. You know you exist because it's you. And that's what he means by knowledge, by identity. But what do we normally do? We normally experience ourselves in different ways. When I have a pain in the leg, I go and touch the leg as if it's somebody else's leg or some object. I look at it. I go and look in the mirror. I treat myself as if I'm a second person. So I have a capacity to know by identity. I have a capacity to know by separateness. Sometimes we have our own experiences, and we also know them that way. If we get overcome with anger, we say, at one stage I say I'm angry now, so don't bother me. At another stage, I don't even think I'm angry, I just become anger. I shout, Or if I'm very happy, I dance and jump up and down in joy, and I lose myself. I said, I'm sorry, I forgot myself. I got carried away. There, I have become identified, not with myself, but with the movement of experience on the surface, with my subjective experience. As I get lost in my emotion, or my anger, my feelings, my sensations, I can get lost in my thought also. We can sit here, you may be talking to me, and suddenly I start getting lost in my own thought, and even though I'm looking at you or shaking my head, I'm really not listening anymore. And I ask you for a minute, did you hear what I said? I'm sorry, I was lost in thought. We can get lost in our own movement of thought because we identify with that. So we do know what knowledge by identity is. We have an identity with ourselves, and we can have an identity with a movement of our experience, an emotion, a sensation, a thought, or a feeling. But this is not our normal experience. Normally, we're neither lost in self-identity, nor are we completely lost in our experience of our subjective things. There's a double movement. There's two things going on. There's some part of us that's experiencing, and there's some part of us that's standing back and observing that experience. If I say, I'm very hungry now, is there anything to eat? What does it mean? It means part of me is feeling the hunger and another part of me is thinking I'm hungry, as if I'm another person. I might as well say, you're hungry, would you like to eat now? I'm treating myself as an object and seeing it both ways. So there's a separation between ourselves and our experience, normally. When Lizzie reads Darcy's letter at Hunsford the first time, she's so angry. She's so provoked by him. She's so disturbed by the proposal that he gave to her and the quarrel she had with him that she's lost. She's not able to control herself. You can say she becomes her anger or her disturbance, or whatever it is. She's not willing to pardon him for anything. She doesn't believe anything in the letter at all. She's lost in the emotion and experience. She's identifying with the movement. But after a while, she reads the letter again. She reads it a third time. She calms down a little. And then she says, after all, I think there's a truth in what he said. After all, I don't think I have a right to be angry with him. She separates herself from the emotions that she has. She looks at it from the point of view of her mind as if her vital emotions are a second person. And she says, now, Elizabeth, be calm, be quiet, be rational, be reasonable, don't get upset, don't be like this. And she says, actually, I think I'm acting absurd. What she means is that my vital is acting absurd and I'm embarrassed about it. I shouldn't be behaving that way. So there's a separation between her subjective experience of anger and her mental observation of that anger as if it's a second person. So this is a separative knowledge where she is both the subject and she's the object. Her emotions are the object. She is watching them as the subject. So we can be lost in our experience. We can step back and watch our experience and be somewhat separate from it. Or we could be completely identified with our inner being and say, that experience has nothing to do with me. I am identified with my soul, I'm identified with the self inside, and all of this I'm not related to. This is me, deep inside. So we do have different ways of experiencing things, and we move back and forth quite rapidly, quite frequently. We get upset, we forget ourselves, then we say to somebody, get a hold of yourself. What does it mean to get a hold of yourself? If you're upset and somebody says, get a hold of yourself, what do we mean? We mean, step back from identifying with your experience. Observe your experience. Detach from your experience. And become a witness. Control yourself, we say. How can we control ourselves? If we are only the experience of the vital impulse of the fear or this excitement, you tell your children that all the time. Control yourself. Sit down. Be quiet. Because we are capable of detaching from our subjective experience and seeing ourselves in a different way. So we have this double knowledge. We can feel the experience directly as ourself because we have a direct contact with it. Or we can detach ourselves and observe from it. Why does all this matter? Why bother with all of this analysis? Already confusing. You expect me to know at each moment whether I'm identified with the self or identified with my emotions or I'm detached from them. Why all of this? Because this is of critical importance to everything we do and everything we want to accomplish in the world. Because this is knowledge. And this knowledge has power. And to have this knowledge fully is to know how to control not only our own surface personality, but to control everything that happens outside us at all, as well, because we find out, and we will find out, that that's also part of ourselves. So this is not of academic importance. All that Appa has taught us about mastery and accomplishment is essentially based on this knowledge. When he says, don't react, what does it mean not to react? How can I not react? I'm angry. He's provoked me. He's insulted me. He's ignoring me. How can I not react? You cannot react because your subjective movement of reaction is only a wave on the surface of the ego. And as long as you are that wave, you're helpless. You're tossed around on the surface of the wave just like a toy boat. There's nothing we can do. We can't be masters of anything. The first thing we have to do is we have to detach from that wave. Detach from that movement, because the power to control it is deeper within. So the knowledge that he's offering, the knowledge that has power, is the knowledge to know what our true self is so that we can control the movements of our surface personality. And that's why when I'm getting upset, Appa says, remember mother. Consecrate. What does it mean? Move away from being lost in that surface movement so that we can go to a deeper, truer source of power within. In our daily life, we kind of maintain some kind of a balance with this. We get excited up to a certain point. We get irritated up to a certain point. And then if it's our boss, we know when to control it because we don't want to get fired. If it's our spouse, we know how far we can go before we get in a fight. And so we go back and forth all the time. We know that we don't have to indulge these things, but we love to do it. We like the intensity of it. Not realizing how much it is binding us and limiting us to the surface, the small surface of our real being. it's easier for us, relatively easy for us, not very easy, but relatively easy, for us to separate from our emotions, our sensations, our upset feelings, or whatever it is. Control yourself. Even if you're very happy, don't express it. Be quiet. Be calm. Don't jump up and down like Lydia and so forth. It's not difficult. It is difficult, but what Lizzie does when she reads his letter at Hunsford, she moves from the vital to the mind. She says, well, I'm observing my behavior from my mind. What's difficult for her to realize is that even the thoughts she's having in her mind are not herself. Just like the feelings of disturbance that she's having in the vital are not herself, her thoughts are not really herself. Her thoughts are another movement on the surface of the ocean. And if she really wants to get knowledge and really wants to get power, she shouldn't be lost in her thoughts. She shouldn't mistake her thoughts for her being, or her thoughts for truth. She should detach from her thoughts the same way that she's detached from her sensations, her emotions, her disturbance, or anything else, and look for something deeper within. We have to break out of this surface consciousness in order to discover the huge world and kingdom of our being that's behind the surface. That's what he's asking us to do. And that's why Mother writes, I've mentioned it many times in these talks, that the first rule of psychic education is don't have faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing things. Why not? Why shouldn't I? Your faith must be in the truth of your inner being. We're still stuck on the surface. Even when I reason to you why you should behave much better or more reasonably to somebody else than you're doing, even if I talk to myself the way Lizzie does and say, oh, I've been acting absurdly, I never knew myself till now. That's true. She never knew herself until now. And she realizes she's been absurd. But it's only half truth because she still doesn't know herself. Even these thoughts are not herself. At that moment, she never realized that she could be Mistress of Pemberley. Never entered her mind. She didn't know she had that potential. She doesn't know the greater self that's behind. So if she insists on being this limited self of hers and saying, I'm an absurd, silly girl, and it's no wonder he doesn't want to marry me and nothing happens to me and I have to be there like this, and maybe she feels she's being very sincere. So I'm being honest. I'm just speaking the truth. It's a sincere ignorance because that's not her real self. If she really wants to know herself, she has to detach from her thoughts just the way she detaches from her feelings and sensations. And we know that detachment is very difficult. Even when Lizzie found out that Wickham was a rogue and a scoundrel, she still felt that attraction to him in her vital. She still felt the appeal of the red coat. She feels it, and yet from another point she looks down and says, this is wrong, this is very silly, I shouldn't have anything to do with that man, that person. So there's a conflict. Her feeling, she's in direct contact. She feels the joy and charm of being in direct contact with him. Her vital is touched by his charm, his feeling. It's pleasant to be with him. Even if her eyes are closed, she just has a happy, pleasant feeling. And her mind is separate and saying, this is not good, be careful, this is a dangerous man. So we have this double way of experiencing the world. What happens to Darcy? When he proposes to her at Hunsford, Darcy is feeling that He took for granted she's going to accept him. He was so lost in his own passion. He wasn't thinking of anything else. He was totally lost in his passion and one with it. She abused him, accused him, told him he's the last man on earth, and made him think. And he had to step back and review his own behavior and see that, well, it's a very painful lesson she has given me, but I see there's truth in it. There's truth in what she says. Even our own body, we can know in different ways. When we have a severe pain, we can just be, or a very pleasant sensation, we can just be kind of carried away by the sensation of the pain. If I get a cramp in my leg, for that second when it's cramping, I forget the world, I forget myself, I forget my name. I'm just, please stop. At other times, oh, my toe is aching. I wonder why it's aching, what happened. I can treat the toe as if it's a separate object. So we have this capacity for identification and separation, to know something by being it, by being one with it, identified with it, to know something by being separate from it and treating it as if it's a second person or a second object, the way you look in the mirror and look at yourself and decide, I wonder how I look today. And what's true for our knowing ourself, we also have for knowing other people. But the problem is, where we can identify with ourselves and our emotions and our feelings, it's very, very much more difficult for us to do that with others. When it comes to the world outside us, we treat everything as if it's not ourselves. Everything as if it's separate from us. It doesn't exist as part of us. We don't have any direct contact with it. If I want to know whether my toe is hurting or not, I can feel it. If I want to know whether I'm hungry or not, I can feel it. I have a direct contact. I don't have to ask anybody. I don't have to even... It's just, I know. If I want to know whether I'm happy or not, I don't have to think. I can feel it directly. But if I want to know whether somebody else's toe is hurting, or whether they're hungry, or whether they're happy, I have no direct contact with that person. I'm shut off from them, separate. And I can only try to know them through the senses. Well, how do they look? Do they look hungry? Does it look like the toe is aching? Do they look happy? So I rely entirely on the senses in order to know what's going on outside of me. But the senses tell us very little. And if that's all that we had to go on, we'd be even much more ignorant than we are today. We have other ways. Even though we rely on the senses, we have a kind of a sense intuition that helps us to figure out what the senses are telling us. Say, when Lizzie sees Darcy staring at her at the dance, she says, why is that man staring at me and condemning me and looking down at me? Because she feels insulted by Darcy, she naturally thinks that Darcy is finding fault with her. But Charlotte says, no, I don't think that's the reason he's staring at you. I think he's attracted to you. I think he likes you. And of course, we know that Charlotte was right. She's not sure. She doesn't have any great spiritual insight. But she has a feeling that when a man is looking at a girl as much as he's looking at her, there's something more to this. So that helps to compensate for the limitation of our sense information. And we have other ways too. We use our mind to reason. That's also what Charlotte does. We use our mind to figure out, say, why he's not looking at any other girl in the room. See, Lizzie, not rich, but she is pretty, and she's very lively, and of all the girls in Meryton, really she's the most extraordinary. And she's so cheerful and happy. I can understand. She uses her mind to supplement what the senses tell her or what her intuition tells her. And she comes up with a conclusion that I think really Darcy's interested in her. He likes her. And then when he comes to Hunsford, Lizzie comes to Hunsford and when Darcy comes to Hunsford, and the first day he's there, he comes and calls at Colin's house. Immediately, Charlotte understands, see, this man is not coming here to meet me or coming here to meet Collins. He's coming to meet Lizzie, and therefore, there really is something. She pieces things together. And this is how we try to know. We try to make up for the limitation of our knowledge of things in the outer world from the senses, from our sense intuition, by using other faculties like reason, like our imagination. We try to imagine what he may be thinking, what he may be feeling. We speculate, we reflect, we weigh things, we infer, we test. Let me see what happens if Lizzie goes somewhere else. Let me see if he follows her eyes there. And through that we come to a conclusion. And sometimes we're pretty proud of our cleverness. We think, I'm quite smart. I know that what he's really thinking. I know what's really going on. But the truth of the matter is that even with all our insights and intuitions and all, most of the time, we're very far wide of the mark. What would be a much better, more typical example of how well we know the world around us is what Lizzie does when she meets Wickham. He's so pleasant. He's so nice. He looks good. He speaks well. Better than that, he speaks well to me. He likes me. That's very important, no? He's chosen to spend his time with me. And from that very pleasant sensation that she got, from the information she got from her senses, from the wild stories that he told her, which she took to be real, she not only comes to the conclusion that Wickham's a handsome and charming man, she does what? What else did she do? She came to the conclusion that he's a good man. She can see his handsome face or his attractive appearance. She can feel his charm. But how did she get to conclude from that he's good? Because she wanted to believe that he's good. So relying on our externalized way of knowing the outer world, mostly, more chances are more of the time we make the mistake of Lizzie than we have a lucky guess like Charlotte. And that's why Mother says, don't have any faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing things. If anybody would like to ask a question on what we're discussing now, not on any other subject, you need not wait for the end of my talk. I'd be happy to, for clarification. So, he says that our surface way of knowing is a knowledge ignorance. It's not a complete ignorance. We're not completely wrong. We're not completely foolish. Something we do know, but it's mixed together with a lot of confusion, a lot of darkness, a lot of misapprehensions, and certainly not the knowledge that's going to give us power. And when it comes to ourselves, we know almost as little about ourselves. In when Darcy's first introduced to Lizzie by Bingley, or who tries to introduce her, the first thing he says is, she's tolerable. He, clearly we know he doesn't know her. But what about himself? Supposing at that point said, Bingley has said to him, Darcy, don't talk that way to her. I know you're capable of marrying that girl. This is the kind of girl you would really like to marry. And what would he say? He said, Bingley, don't talk nonsense. You don't know me at all. But what's the truth? Is it that Bingley doesn't know Darcy at all? Or is it that Darcy doesn't know himself at all, doesn't know what he's capable of? When Darcy proposes to Lizzie at Hunsford, and she rejects him, and she says, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry, she believes she's right. She believes she knows what she's talking about. She not only believes that she knows that Darcy is a very abominable person, which turns out later to be wrong, but she's equally sure, or I would say even more sure, that she could never marry a man like Darcy. But she was wrong. So we're really in a double ignorance here. We not only don't know other people, we don't know ourselves. And if you ask Darcy later, Darcy, why did you speak and call her tolerable? Why did you do that? And why did you do it in a loud voice? Why did you do it so loud that she could hear you? Isn't that really abominable? What would he say honestly? Yeah, I don't know. What you say is right. I don't appreciate it. It's not right for a gentleman to speak loudly about another, about a woman or anybody like that. I don't know why I spoke it. I don't know why I said it so loud. I don't know why I didn't whisper it. Some impulse came there. And we might be able to tell Darcy why he spoke it loud. And I wonder if any of you can. If we don't know now, when we get to the second station on our journey, we should be able to figure out, at least guess, why Darcy called her tolerable in a loud voice, which he himself doesn't know. And Bingley came up to Darcy and said, Darcy, why don't you dance? I'll have you dance. Don't be stupid. Why did Bingley call him stupid? If you ask Bingley, why do you call Darcy stupid? That's not the way you normally talk to him. He'll say, I don't know. I don't know what got into me. But something got into him. Where it got into him, how it got into him. He did it. He should know. Shouldn't we know why we're acting? But the truth of the matter is, most of the time, we also don't know why we do what we do, many of the things we do, even when we think we're very reasonable people. So our problem is not just knowing other people, our problem is knowing ourselves as well. Rather, Sri Aurobindo would say, our real problem is knowing ourselves, not other people. Because if we fully know ourselves, we will also know other people. Why? How? Because other people are not self. Other people are our other selves. They are part of us. And if we really want to know them, we can only do it by knowing ourselves. When Lizzie reads his letter at Hunsford, she says, oh, this is really a terrible. I never knew myself till now. She never knew herself until she read Darcy's letter and realized how absurd she was to run after Wickham and believe everything he said. But the truth of the matter is, even at this point, she doesn't know herself. She doesn't know what's coming. She doesn't know what she's capable of. Even at that point when she never knew herself, she still feels that Wickham, what he did with Georgiana, is just a casual error of youth. She doesn't know how deeply she's still attracted to him, in spite of the fact that he's a rogue. So she's only still at the home station in this journey of self-discovery to the inner spirit. she's still fully in the ignorance. So this is our situation. We're concentrated on the surface. Our real being in the depths is shut away from us by a wall. A wall that makes us feel our real being is not us. When you talk about your soul, how many of you really feel it's your true self? Soul means it's like a second person. I want to find my soul. It's like finding an object, a precious gem, some treasure that's buried. What you're really trying to do is find yourself. But we're so shut off from it that it feels like a second person. And of course, that's true of the divine also, because when we pray to the divine, why is the divine ignoring me? Why is she, mother, is not giving me what I want? Why he's not listening to me? Why he, all of this? We talk as if the divine is a second person. Whereas the truth is, the divine is our true self. So we are cut off by a wall, an inner wall, that blocks us from knowing, not some buried treasure inside, from knowing who we are, from knowing the real why we are here, from knowing what we have come for. And at the same time, there's another wall that blocks us from the world outside, so that everybody I meet, everything I see, looks to be separate from me, looks to be unconnected with me. And therefore I ask you, how are you feeling? Or I try to look and analyze with my senses and my evidence and try to figure things out, because I have no contact with that. And what we will learn is, it is not a not-self out there. You and I are not not-self to each other, other, completely separate. We are parts of the same reality. And when we really know ourselves and are in touch with ourselves, we will also be really in touch with each other without the use of asking how you are, looking at you and trying to examine or infer or imagine or something else. So this is our problem. It's an ignorance. We're got a double wall. We're trapped in this tiny little territory with the huge outer world universe on one side and an infinite inner world of spirit on the other, and we're living in this tiny little region in between and trying to know things. And that's the home station from where we start our journey. But the truth is, we're not alone. We're not really separate. This sense of being separate, so I will take my own decisions and I will do what I want to do, this is what I think. All of that's an illusion. Because all the time, what we are on this little narrow area is being influenced by what's going on around us. Though there's a double wall, there's constant communication coming in from both sides, which we're not aware of. We're not aware that maybe if we start changing the way we comb our hair or the way we dress, we may not be aware that we're imitating the fashions that are going on outside us. When we change the color of the dress that we buy, or we choose a different type of cell phone, or prefer a different type of car or anything, we won't be aware that we are taking from the outer social environment, imitating what the society is telling us, and thinking, no, I prefer this color, I prefer this brand, I like this or that, and we take it as our own, as if I'm an independent person. We are not conscious of how much is coming from the world all the time and how much it's influencing us. But the same is true from inside. That's more interesting. We're not conscious of how much our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our urges on the surface are really not coming from this at all. They're coming from this huge inner being we have, which he calls the subliminal. when I suddenly begin to feel a fear for no reason at all. I don't know why I'm feeling a fear today. Or I don't know, I'm feeling very happy today. I think Janani pointed out that when Lizzie was told that they can't go to Lake Country and she's going to Derbyshire, initially she was disappointed, but then she just felt a very happy feeling for no particular reason. She didn't know what her inner being knew, that she's going to Pemberley. She would never think of going to Pemberley. She didn't know that she's going to meet the man who's going to be her future husband. But something in her knew. Because though we think we live on the surface, we're all the time open to influences that are coming from deeper in our being. This double wall of self-imprisonment we live in, which is the ego, it's only a temporary residence for us. It's not our permanently where we're intended to be. It's a temporary residence that nature has created to help develop our individuality, to help us develop a center, a separate center, so that we're not flooded and acting the way everybody else acts, so that we're not lost by this infinite consciousness behind. We need some place, quiet, a little calm, where we can try to sort out and begin to develop our sense of individuality. But that's not ourself. If we really want to know ourselves, we have to go inside. And this is the constant message of this book. Maybe if you go back and read the chapters carefully, you'll find, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised, if every chapter of the book he tells us at least once, sometimes in every paragraph, it's only by going inside, away from the surface, that we can really find ourselves, and that we can really have knowledge, that we can really have power. We have to go within to our inner being and learn to live there, and learn to live from there. The outer life and outer mind, he's not asking us to become sannyasis and give up the world. He's not asking us to give up the experiences of the outer life and the mind. But he's saying this should be the antechamber, not where we really live. This should be like the outside of the house, the front porch. But we really live inside. And this is only the place we go for our interactions with the experiences in the outer world. It's not the center of our existence. All that we are outside is conditioned by what we are and what is within us, a cult. From there, he says, come all the secret initiatives, self-affecting inspirations, intuitions, motives, preferences that are affecting our outer behavior. Why Darcy called her stupid or tolerable? I don't know, I can only guess. But I think that in his inner being, he knew that he was attracted to her. His outer personality says that I can never have anything to do with somebody from Meryton with inferior connections. But something deep inside felt that attraction to her. He wanted to relate to her. His outer mind refused to allow him to relate to her positively, civilly, by dancing with her. So when he spoke tolerable, something in him made him speak more loudly than he should properly speak, so that she would hear it to forge that relationship with her. It may sound odd, but that's the truth. It did forge the relationship with her. From that moment on, she's thinking of Darcy all the time. The whole rest of the story, even if she thinks she hates him, she's constantly thinking of him. It forged the relationship. It made a contact of intensity that ultimately led to their marriage. Why did Wickham come to Meryton when he came? The last place on the world that he wants to consciously come is to where Darcy is. He's trying to avoid Darcy because Darcy's the one person in the world who can expose him for all of his lies and everything. What brought him there? Because he did not know Darcy was there. He was not seeking Darcy outwardly. But inside, in his subliminal, he is fully attached to Darcy. For him, Darcy's the center of his life. Pemberley is the center of his life. So he constantly is brought into that contact, even when he's trying to hide from Darcy. And why, when Darcy's going to marry, thinking of proposing to Lizzie at Pemberley, at Lambton Inn, Wickham comes again. He doesn't come physically. He comes through the news of elopement. Because something deep in Wickham wants to relate intensely, wants to be part of Darcy's life. And he ends up that way. And now you can understand why Darcy could find Wickham in London, and Mr. Bennett and Mr. Gardner couldn't. Because something in Wickham, who was trying to hide from everybody, wanted to be found. Not on the surface. On the surface, he's trying to keep it all a secret. But at the subliminal level, he wants to be found. What brought Collins to Meryton at this time? I mean, after what made him come just at this time to propose to one of the girls there? On the surface, we say because Lady Catherine told him that they go out and get married. You're a clergyman now. You're a respectable man with an education and a position. So you should get married. But what really made it happen at this time? I don't know. We can only conjecture. But on the surface, he thinks, see, these Bennets, my father quarreled with his cousin for a long time, and now it's a good thing that I make it up. But what's the truth of the matter? The truth of the matter is the Bennets are about to rise sky high in the world. Nobody knows it yet. They don't know it on the surface yet. Darcy doesn't know it. Lizzie doesn't know it. Lady Catherine doesn't know it. But something somewhere knows it. And that brings Wickham, and that brings Collins, because they want to be part of that. Just as if they were attracted because they heard that there's a gold mine and gold has been discovered in Meryton. Our subliminal knows what our surface doesn't know, because it's a much wider, vaster field, and it has much greater powers of knowledge, which he's going to tell us about in this chapter. But the knowledge that comes to us from deep within, it depends on how we receive it on the surface, what happens. When Bingley tries to get Darcy to dance with Lizzie, what does Darcy do? Instead of accepting the opportunity, he abuses her. When Darcy comes and proposes to her, what does she do? She abuses him. Of course, we all feel she was justified in doing it. When Mr. Bennett is warned about sending Lydia to Brighton, he sends her anyway. These are the ways, this is what we're doing all the time. Life is telling us and giving us a knowledge, or an inner intuition is trying to come up. But we don't follow it, we ignore it, we push it aside, and we do the very opposite. No sense blaming Collins and Darcy and Lizzie and Mr. Bennett or Lydia or anybody else. This is what the human consciousness does. We have a knowledge within us. We constantly ignore it. We constantly ignore it to do what we want on the surface, to follow our surface understanding, our surface preferences, and particularly the inclinations of our ego. My prestige is important. My status is important, and all. So I have to do this. So In order to get the knowledge, we have to go within. We have to leave this ego. We have to become aware of what our true self is. The truth of the matter is that we completely miss the purpose for which we're here. I think I'm here to be important, or I'm here to earn a lot of money, or I'm here to be famous or popular or what it is, or to have nice things. We completely miss the purpose for which our being, our soul, has come here. Just like Darcy misses the purpose for which he came to Meryton. In fact, it's hard to imagine why he came to Meryton, because he became so distasteful to everybody. He was really searching for a soulmate. I'm calling soulmate. He was searching for the love, the affection that he needed in life, and then completely ignored that when it was presented to him. She completely rejects her own destiny when he begins to politely relate to her. It's interesting, even Sri Aurobindo, after fighting for freedom, getting thrown into Alipur jail, he writes, he said that the British thought they were putting me in prison. Actually, they were putting me in the my ashramam, where he could have great spiritual experiences. That was the first thing he wanted to do when he left prison. He wanted to go back to the freedom fight. Only then, when he heard that inner voice there coming and he escaped, only then he realized that this is not what God wants him to do. This is not his real destiny. There's a beautiful scene in Savitri, in the Book of Love, where she's been sent out into the world to look for a proper husband, a prince, to be her princess. And her chain of chariots is going through the forest at a speed, and suddenly she sees a figure walking out of the forest, emerging from the path, this beautiful, handsome, young, princely man. She looks at him and looks away and continues. And then something in her stops and halts everything, because the soul has come forward and told her, this is the man I'm looking for. But even for Savitri, the first response was, she looks and looks away. Mother is coming to us. Grace is coming to us through life all the time, and our first response is to look away. Like the blind man who closes his eyes when Shiva drops the gold bar on the floor. Because that's the surface consciousness. That's the surface ignorance. And we not only do it, but we justify doing it and explain why we're doing it and why we're right to do it. Sometimes we recognize this tendency of ours and we want to counter it. So instead of saying, yes, I'm right, everything I do is correct, we take the opposite view and say, yes, everything I do is wrong. Yes, I'm worthless. I'm egoistic. I'm selfish. I know all of that. What Sri Aurobindo says is that this is another poise of the same vital ego. Whether I'm proud of myself like Darcy and asserting my importance. Ashok?
Mary?
Yes, Ashok.
I'm a little confused. You see, how can a person develop his own individuality while at the same time increasing his universality, which is what will happen if you increase your identity with others? I believe a person can develop his individuality only by cutting himself off from others. To the extent he cuts himself off from others, he will develop his own individuality, which will be ego-based. The more he develops his identity with others, the more his universal personality will develop, which will be at the cost of his own individuality. So I believe the individual side of a person's personality and the universal side, they are not compatible. They are kind of opposed to each other. Do you understand my point?
It's a very good question, Ashok. It's a very good question. I think the answer is, right now, where we live, the consciousness we live in is not the consciousness of ourself. It's not the consciousness of an individual. Our consciousness is all the time at the mercy of the universe outside and the forces that are coming to us from our subliminal, which we don't even know about. As I was trying to illustrate, why Darcy calls her tolerable, or Bingley calls him stupid, or Wickham comes when he comes, or any of this, is not them exercising individuality. They're unconscious. What does it mean to be an individual? Let's start there. What does it really mean to be an individual? To be an individual means, first of all, I must be conscious. If I'm not conscious of why I'm doing something, if I'm being moved because I want the attention of other people, or if I'm imitating what other people do because I want to be approved by them, I'm not being an individual. If I'm being moved by hidden forces coming from my own subliminal that I'm not aware of, whatever they may be, I'm not being an individual, no matter if I act like everybody or I act the opposite of everybody else. In order to be an individual, first of all, I must know who I really am and what I am. What is my destiny? What is my soul here for? Why I am on earth? Why things are happening to me? If I don't know why things are happening to me, and I don't know what in me is making them happen, I cannot be a real individual. And if I don't have that knowledge, then I cannot have the power of individuality. If I feel fear suddenly, and I don't know why I feel fear, I won't have power over that fear. Mother says, as long as we feel fear, we're not human. As long as we feel fear, we're still animals. So I must not only know why the fear comes, I must know it comes from outside, and I must be able to overcome that fear, which I can only do by this deeper knowledge. Have I answered your question?
You say the mother is against fear.
I don't say she's against fear. I'm telling you what she says about it.
But I find old religions organized on the basis of breeding fear about yes. God and his punishments.
Exactly. Very right. Very right. They are not religions of spirituality, and they're not trying to create higher consciousness. You're right. They're trying to keep people. That's okay for the below average person who otherwise will do all the wrong things. They use fear as an incentive to prevent them from doing wrong things. But that's not individuality, I think you'll agree. Individuality
is
doesn't come
not
because
individuality,
I don't
see it. I will admit.
We're talking about something beyond the average of the world, something for which our soul has come and our progress. That won't come out of acting by fear. I think you know that. You know, when we talk about Steve Jobs, if Steve Jobs has acted the way he did out of a complex because his parents abandoned him at birth, that's not true individuality. He may have a strain or of individuality in his personality when it comes to the design of a beautiful product and all. But everything he does out of a reaction against the society, it's not individuality. It's another version of fear. It's a complex. Unless he knows that, unless he's aware of that complex in himself and what in him is making him act in such an abominable way, such an antisocial way, such a rebellious way, he cannot become a true individual. True individuality is not to be a rebel any more than it's to be a conformist. True individual is to know the depths of our own being and express that truth in life.
What I am intrigued about is that I find the mother to be a powerful spiritual individual. But at the same time, I am also aware that she has a universal dimension to her personality, and both this powerful individual side and the powerful universal side are coexisting without causing any friction between themselves. This is totally confusing. Either you are a powerful individual or you are a powerful universal personality. There is no possibility in my understanding for both these contradictory sides to exist within the same person.
Are they contradictions? Are they opposites? You take them, the mind takes them to be two separate things unconnected with each other. They're not. Your private life as a person at home and your life as an officer of the society or as a prime minister or a business executive or whatever it else are not two different lives. We may say this is my one life and that's my other life. I'm acting as an officer and now I'm acting as a person. But they're not totally separate from one another. They're two different expressions of your power of personality. One in which you're acting on behalf of something larger. I'm giving it only as an analogy. It's not identical. Mother's universal, transcendent, and individual personalities are not of three different beings. The truth of the matter is, our own soul, the cosmic spirit, and the transcendent divine are not three different things. The whole thing he's trying to tell us, and the knowledge he wants to give us in this chapter, is to discover that they are at a deepest level, at the level of real knowledge, which is knowledge by identity. It is all one being. It's the same being. And the reason we can know Mother, the reason we can... Sri Aurobindo says, why do you want to worship God when you become God? How can you become God? Because in the depths of your being, you are God. That is the truth of your being. The only thing is, we're trapped living on the surface. The mind sees it as an inconsistency because you take it as two separate, independent things. They're two sides of the same thing. Let's go further, and if there's still some doubts about it, you raise it again. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks for the question. Good question. Now we're leaving the home station, and we're going into the inner world of the subliminal being. And if we haven't read this before, and nobody's told us what Sri Aurobindo says, we may be surprised to find that our real being is in there, not on the surface. And that that being is not some tiny little thing, it's much larger than what's here on the surface. And we have a mental being and a vital being and even a subtle physical being in the subliminal, which still has an individuality to it. It's not just the rest of the universe. And it's from there that all types of impulses, guidance, suggestions, thoughts, feelings, motives of action, energies are coming. and coming and influencing our surface personality even when we don't know it. And the first step for us to go towards knowledge is we have to detach from our surface personality and enter into this inner country, identify with it, and discover the truths of ourself that are much deeper than on the surface. We have to discover this secret inner being. We have to discover the thought that's coming to us from inside, the feeling that's coming from inside, all the influences that are coming on the surface. On the surface, they come, we're totally confused. We said, how can I tell whether a thought's coming from inside or outside, whether it's my thought or somebody else's thought or anything? I can't see it all. It's cloudy. And that's true. But when you go into the subliminal, things become much clearer. You begin to see the origin of things which are not clear on the surface. You have a clear light vision where now we have struggle. On the surface, we are full of contradictions and struggling, even among ourselves, let alone with other people. Like Darcy, when he proposes to Lizzie, his mind says, don't have anything to do with this family and their inferior connections, and his heart says, I want you. So there's a struggle going on. When you go into the inner depths, that clarity will be there. That struggle won't be there. When Lizzie's on the surface, she says, this Wickham is so nice and so charming, I want him. But the mind's telling her he's a scoundrel. She doesn't know how to handle it. She doesn't know what is attracting her to him and what is warning her against him. But when she goes into the inner depths, she not only gains a greater knowledge, but she gains a greater power over those influences, so that she's not subjected to him just because he smiles at her flatters her. Nothing in her will be carried away. She will feel the falsehood of the vibration. This is especially true if we can go to the depths of the subliminal where our psychic is. Find the psychic that's in the cave there, because once we reach the psychic, we will know the truth of every vibration that comes to us. We will know its origin. We will know its nature. We will know whether we should accept it or we shouldn't. But we don't have that knowledge on the surface. So our first task is to enter into the subliminal. When we go to the subliminal, we also find there's different ways of our knowing. There's also this four different ways that we can know. But the dominant way, there are senses in the subliminal. As we have our physical senses and we can know things outside through the senses, there are subtle senses, which are much more powerful than our physical senses. We can see things in the subtle that we don't, way beyond our physical range. We can hear things. We can sense things that we can't with the physical senses. We can also have, but we don't need just the senses. The subliminal can have a direct contact with others, can have a direct contact in consciousness with others. We can feel what they feel. We can understand, we can perceive their thought directly. We can know what's in their mind and understand it. Mother once said that Sri Aurobindo and her used to have conversations which, if anybody heard them, would think it doesn't make any sense at all. Because he would say one thing, and then sometime later she would say something else, and it would look like it's on a totally different subject, but they would understand each other totally. And you may have noticed with people you're very close to, or where there's a harmony of thought or a harmony of feeling, that, yes, yes, I was just thinking the same thing. Or the moment you begin to explain, you don't have to explain, I understand. You don't have to give an explanation and then I should try to figure out what you're saying and respond to it. No, there's a direct contact, a thought with thought, or a feeling with feeling. That can be positive or it can be negative. I would say that when Carolyn and Lizzie met, there was a direct, before they even talked, there was a direct perception Carolyn was jealous of this girl, understood that Lizzie's a threat to her and her plans. It comes out beautifully when Lizzie goes to Rosings and meets Lady Catherine. Because in the very first conversation, Lady Catherine gets disturbed by Lizzie. She's attracted, she's disturbed. Because in the subliminal, she doesn't know it on the surface. In the subliminal, she understands this is a girl who can carry away my Darcy and ruin all my plans. Ashok, you wanted to ask something?
Yes. See that all those people who have an eye consciousness, we know that so long as you feel the eye kind of awareness, you are operating in the ego. People with the egoistic awareness feel an eye inside them. That it's that feeling of eye that makes them feel separate from others. Now it is said that the divine descent feels separate from his own creation and he feels kind of one with it. Mm. Now when you feel one with your own creation, what does that mean? Instead of the, what kind of self-awareness will the divine have about himself? Instead of feeling an I, will he be feeling we?
It's a very good question.
Because unless he feels we, he won't be one with his own creation. No?
This, you have asked the question which comes at the end of this chapter. You're not quite the end, but you're jumping to the third station on the, or the fifth station on our journey from the second station, but it doesn't matter. Because it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. Let me put it, I'm going to use the analogy. See if the analogy is clear. Jane Austen creates a story. All that she creates, all the characters in the story, are aspects of her own consciousness, creations of her own creative consciousness. She enjoys the creation of them. She enjoys the story she has created. She enjoys the interaction between the characters she's created. She also can identify with each one of these characters and experience it from their point of view. Experience how Lizzie feels when Darcy proposes or Jane gets rejected by Bingley or Lady Catherine comes and abuses her or whatever it is. She can feel all the experiences of Lizzie, but she can also feel all the experiences of Lady Catherine and Carolyn and Darcy and Bingley and Jane and Lydia and so forth. And she can experience the story in its totality. And at the same time, she can be the author who's beyond all of these. She can experience it transcendentally as the author, universally identifying with not just all the characters, with each character. With each character in their relationship with each of the other characters. Each of these gives her a delight. Each of these gives us her a knowledge. Each of these is part of her creative self-expression. What Sri Aurobindo tells us is, contrary to the traditional notion that the spirit, the superconscient, is to just to be aware of the one and nothing else, What he says is the supramental consciousness is to be aware at all these levels simultaneously. The only difference is, that when Jane Austen experiences from the point of view of Lizzie and Darcy and Jane and Bingley and Wickham and so forth, she doesn't lose her consciousness of herself as the author. When she experiences one, she doesn't experience Jane and Lizzie and Darcy and Lydia as separate, completely independent people. She experiences each one as an aspect of her own being. So when Darcy proposes to her, it's not the not self of a stranger, an unconnected, totally unconnected person. She calls Lady Catherine a totally unconnected person. It's not a totally, there are no totally unconnected people for her. They're all selves of herself. They're all other expressions of her. And she has that triple knowledge. She has the knowledge of Lizzie, the individual, at the same time, the knowledge that she's also all the other people whom Lizzie is interacting with, and a third thing, that she's not limited to any of these. She's something transcendent and universal beyond them all. And that is the supramental experience. It's not to give up one type of ignorance for another. She has the delight, and that's how she experiences the delight in it. Because even when Lady Catherine is abusing her, she doesn't feel the abuse. She sees another part of herself interacting with her to bring out a hidden potential in her and help her discover more of herself. It's a dance. It's not a real combat. I used that analogy once when Jackie Chan or any of these martial arts people, now every movie has it, is got a fight scene. What we see as a fight scene, when they're actually filming it, it's a dance scene. It's just like a dance. They're orchestrated in such a way, maybe they speed up the film at the end to make it look like a fight. It's the same way you make a dance scene, you make a fight scene, except that you make it look like people are hitting each other instead of gracefully moving beyond each other. Life is that for the divine vision. Everything is a dance. When Lady Catherine comes in and abuses her, it's only to awaken greater potential that's hidden in her. So the divine consciousness has all the three poises. And that's our destiny. That's what it means when the individual fully realizes its destiny. The individual has the joy of every other, the knowledge that's there in every other being, and the knowledge that's beyond all. It's going to come later in the chapter. He writes about it. All are within the self. That's Jane Austen, the author. The self as in all. That's Jane Austen, each of the characters. All the characters dwell in her. All the three are different parts of the same truth. For us, we're living in division on the surface, and so it all looks like separate things. This is the knowledge he wants us to discover.
Mary?
Yes, Bob.
The film audience really knows that what they are witnessing as a fight scene is something like a dance rehearsal. They will feel very badly deceived.
but we do know that for sure, no? Nobody really gets killed or gets their bones broken in a dance scene. You do know that, even when you watch it. But you still watch it. You do it with a double consciousness. You know that this is a dance, but you watch it as if it's a fight.
I have not seen a fight scene being filmed, so because you are telling me...
You know for sure that when somebody kills somebody in the movie, that they don't die. I think you don't have that illusion. You do have that knowledge. But you keep behind you so you can enjoy the intensity of the fight, even though you know it's not a fight at all. After all, the same character who you see dying in one movie comes back in next week in another movie.
Are you saying that divine is enacting some such deception?
It's not a deception. It's a different way of looking at it. It's a different perspective of looking at it. Darcy and Elizabeth really do quarrel on the surface. But that's not the whole of their truth. They're quarreling to give up. Lizzie is coming to help Darcy, not to hurt him. Lizzie is coming to liberate Darcy from his arrogant selfishness. Darcy is coming to liberate Lizzie from her subconscious vulgar attraction to a rogue. Wickham himself is coming to scandalize Darcy in order to awaken Darcy to the truth of his own being. It's a fight on the surface. Lady Catherine comes to, apparently she comes to prevent Lizzie from marrying Darcy, but actually what she does is she helps Lizzie marry Darcy. The appearance on the surface is not the truth. We mistake the appearance for the reality, and we say that Wickham's a bad man and Lady Catherine's a bad lady. But actually, the story is a success only because of them. If you have the supermental knowledge, you won't make that mistake. You will still see the quarrel. You will still see the scandal. You will see the falsehood of it, but you will know the purpose for which it's serving and the value that it has. And learn from that experience, which is what Darcy does. He does it. I'm not just talking philosophy. When Lizzie abuses him, he does learn from that. Maybe he felt some pain because he's identified with the falsehood of his ego. But he gives it up and discovers a joy. What Darcy does unconsciously is what we can do consciously. The more conscious we become inside, the more we will understand each thing that comes to us. You understand this, that if when Darcy proposed to her the first time and she abused him, supposing he had had the knowledge that after all, this girl's going to marry me. After all, she's telling me the conditions, I have to change, and then she'll marry me. I'm very happy. She said yes. She said I'm the last man, but she's really telling me yes. So let me go and do what I should do. Let me get rid of my falsehood and my ignorance. She's done me a great service. And Wickham has scandalized me, but he's also helped because he made Lizzie speak out in very clear terms, telling me what I can do to get what I want. So the abuse is there, but the value of it, the external conflict is really determined by an inner, a very different inner cause. And this is what Sri Aurobindo says in Life Divine. I can show you many lines where he says, what we take as conflict on the surface is not conflict. It's the harmonious expression of a supramental intention below the surface. It's conflict to our ignorant surface consciousness, which we have to change or move away from.
See, Gary, this is all there so long as you are confining the issue to psychological encounters. But what about a downright physical illness? According to you, you seem to be saying that the physical illness is not a mere illness as superficially it appears to be, but that the life is teaching the person some kind of lesson, and so when the person learns the lesson that the illness wants to convey, the illness should go.
Well, fortunately, it's not that I'm saying it, and you don't have to rely on my word. This is what Mother says. This is exactly what she says. All experiences come to us. All, not part, not 3 out of 5 or 9 out of 10. All experiences come to us to offer us a knowledge for our soul's progress. And if we get that knowledge, we make the progress, and the sooner we get it, the faster the progress we make. And Appa's theme is that the knowledge we acquire in 60 or 70 or 80 years, we can acquire in 5 or 10 or 15 years. And he's saying most of that knowledge we can give to our children by the age of 5. Which, of course, sounds ridiculous, except that we do give to our children by the age of 5 knowledge that most people didn't have at the age of 70, 50 years ago.
So, is it possible that a person with a long-standing illness cannot figure out what is it that life is trying to teach him? This is highly incredulous. I mean, according to
that Mrs. Bennett doesn't learn the lessons in her life. You see that, no? Mrs. Bennett goes through almost a disaster, narrowly escapes, and then blames everybody else, and says, next time I must go to Brighton also. Why? She refuses to
understand with respect to psychological experiences.
No, no. What's the answer from psychology? Because she enjoys being what she is. Because she's enjoying the taste of ignorance. As long as these experiences come to us to ask us to give up the taste of ignorance, to enjoy at a higher level, it's the soul's choice whether to do that or not. That's the option we have. But that doesn't change the reality of the situation. We can give up that. We can. It wasn't easy for Darcy. You say it's only psychological. I don't know how many people could have taken his experience and made the progress he made, even though you say it was very painful for him. The principle is there. This is not what I'm saying. This is the knowledge that Mother and Sri Aurobindo are giving. I would say this, if you have difficulty accepting it for illness, leave that aside for a long, accept it for everything else. Can you accept it for everything psychological? Can you accept that everything that people do to you, say about you, behave towards you, that is unpleasant and unpardonable, is coming for your progress? I would say, if so, this chapter has done a great service. And we can take up illness in the next chapter or sometime later. Instead of taking that as an occasion to, this is a great knowledge, precious knowledge he's offering us. He's not trying to criticize, find fault with, or anything. He's trying to liberate us. So if you say, well, out of all that you say, I can only accept 50%, then let's accept 50% and do it. Can we do it? Can we do it even for 24 hours? When somebody gives me tea and forgets to put the sugar or put salt in or puts in 3 times the salt, can we do it even at this level and understand and try to make the progress we should make?
See, I will give you one small incident. Last week I went to the garden. I ended up provoking the manager there. But I was not aware that I was provoking him because he wasn't revealing his irritation. Even as I was talking with the manager, a big ant bit me in my toe, causing me severe pain. It has never happened to me before, but suddenly that big ant was biting my toe and causing tremendous pain. I immediately understood I must be provoking him by what I am saying. He's not showing his irritation, but the ant is showing his irritation towards me.
Great, great. Hats off to the ant.
Even though I understood that it's my irritating the manager which has brought about the biting of the ant, the pain didn't diminish at all. It persisted for 10 more minutes.
But then you must understand that just because you understood that, the pain that you were inflicting on the manager didn't disappear just instantly either. It might last for 10 years. You're thinking only from one limited point of view. Now I have understood, so my pain should go away. But you haven't fully understood, because you haven't fully understood that the manager's pain is also yours. The residue, see, why the aunt, and I have stopped biting the manager, but the aunt has stopped biting me. My pain should go away. I've stopped biting the manager. His pain should go away. But this aunt is telling you, just because you stop biting doesn't mean the manager's pain goes away. It may last for 10 minutes, 10 hours, 10 weeks, or forever.
And this happened to me when I was carrying protection flowers inside my pocket.
Great, great. Then it was only an ant. It's only a 10-minute thing. I'd say, that's great. Don't you see what a valuable knowledge is given? It's not a punishment. What a wonderful knowledge for 10 minutes of pain you have gotten. Because we're so unconscious, if an ant doesn't come and bite us, we may go on doing this our whole lives. We may be causing infinite pain to so many people without even realizing it. So the ant comes to help us awaken. Wonderful.
My one question was, what was the role of the protection flowers? Why did the protection flowers fail?
They didn't fail. They gave you a precious knowledge at a minimum price. Why do you think it failed?
This would mean, had I not carried the protection flowers,
yeah,
the punishment would have been bigger.
If you were not a mother's devotee, if you were not surrounded by mother's consciousness, the kind of experiences you must have in life in order to gain this knowledge, maybe 100 times, well, let's not talk about them and invoke them. You can easily imagine things much, much worse. Exactly. You got a precious knowledge for a 10-minute experience, and as you know, it's not the first time you have been are trying to learn this lesson. This is not like, suddenly life comes and bites you. This is a lesson you have been learning for years and have not fully learned. As you yourself will agree, when Lydia elopes with Wickham and brings the whole family to the edge of ruin, supposing Lizzie is in this conversation, and she says, I went through 1 month of pain. What kind of protection was there? You say, Mother is protecting me. What kind of protection is there? I said, Lizzie, you were warned about this 6 months ago by Darcy, and you refused to learn it. When you refuse to learn without any pain, or simply by a psychological, by the pain of reading his letter, now you had to go through that experience. So the very fact that it had to come to an ant bite means, because we have refused to learn it without the physical bite, without that it, as the minimum condition. Mother's not trying to punish anybody. She tries to give you the knowledge with the very minimum of inconvenience and the maximum of protection. If we don't get it, it's because we ignore all of the lessons and refuse to learn what we should learn, which is what we all do so often.
What does it tell about my level if after so many years I still have to learn through physical punishment?
I will leave that answer to you. That's a very good question for all of us to learn from. It's a good, sincere question to reflect on. Why does this experience happen to me? The goal of that is to minimize the need of that repetition in future. The right thing is, let me make all the progress I should make from all the experiences, not the ones I'm having or going to have, all the experiences I've already had, let me learn everything I should learn from them now. Then no ant bites need come in future. That is what consecration is. That's why Appa talks about consecration of the past, because we've had so many ant bites in the present, in the past, which we've not learned anything from. So let's go back and take advantage of every lesson that has come to us, and at least every lesson that comes now, because it'll never be easier to learn than it is now. You'll never get a better opportunity.
Okay.
Very good question. Wonderful question. Okay. So, he says, go into the subliminal consciousness, become aware. We can become not only aware of the influences that are coming from within, deeper in our own being, but we can also become directly aware of the thoughts and feelings of those around us. We're in a constant invisible interchange with other people, which we're not aware of. When that interchange becomes conscious, we become more and more conscious in our subliminal part. We will no longer be the involuntary victims or subjects. We'll also have the power to reject those things. If I feel I'm afraid, it's very difficult for me to handle it. If I know that fear is coming from outside, that knowledge itself gives me a power to handle it. If I feel irritated and I know I'm unhappy, I'm depressed, what do I do about it? I feel hopeless. Helpless. If I know that depression is coming because of somebody's thinking of me or like that, oh, it is their depression that I am, let me not have that. I don't want it. I separate from it. I throw it away. I push it away. This, the more we go inside, the more we gain a power to protect ourselves against what is now coming to us unconsciously. Not only that, but our own actions on other people. We're also, it's not a one-way street. If fear or anxiety or irritation or depression can come from outside on us, it can come from us to other people as well. The more conscious we are, the more we can see that only the most benevolent goodwill, cheerfulness, and everything goes from us to other people. Whereas now, it works in both directions. See, Lizzie, it takes the initiative to bring Wickham to Longbourn, and the moment Wickham comes in the house, Jane gets a letter that Bingley has run off to London and he's not coming back. If Lizzie has known that bringing in this influence of Wickham is going to spoil the happiness of her sister, she never would have done it. But it's her attachment and attraction to Wickham's false consciousness that cancels the possibilities for Jane. Why? Because it's her goodwill for Jane that brought Bingley in the first place. She wants Jane to be happy, so she brings the good possibility for him, but her own attraction to Wickham cancels that out. So if she knows the truth of what's going on inside her, she'll not only be able to help herself much more, she'll be able to help others much more. The truth is, there are things coming to us from the life around all the time, but we're not conscious of them, so we're trying to make up for that by straining on the surface. If we go within, we'll have that deeper knowledge. The deeper we go towards the psychic and the more we act from there, the greater will be our power in life. Chandrasekharan told a wonderful story inspiring story. I won't tell it properly, but it's about a warrior prince, Rana Pratap, who was opposing to the Mughal emperor. Maybe it was Akbar, I'm not sure. And the emperor sent an army to destroy Rana Pratap. And after a long time, they managed to isolate and surround the Rana's forces, and they were trapped within a forest area surrounded by the general, the Mughal general and his troops, huge troops. And it was only a matter of a couple of days before they would close in and destroy them. The general's wife and daughter had come along with him because for them it was an outing and an interesting opportunity to see the countryside. And one evening the wife and daughter just wandered into the beautiful forest area adjacent to the camp. They got lost. And they were found by the Rana's son. And he took them and brought them to the Rana. And he was very proud, and he said, see, now we have the daughter and wife of the general. Now we can hold them at ransom for our escape, and maybe even for a big ransom as well. Rana Pratap says, I cannot hold a woman and a child at ransom, even for my own life, even for the life of my kingdom. That's not possible. You take them back, you escort them back to the general with some gifts that I'm sending him. I'm not asking anything in return. When the general saw his wife and daughter coming back and sent, escorted by the son of Rana, like this, without any conditions or anything, the general told the boy, the son, said in his presence, tonight we're going to have a big celebration to celebrate the return of my wife and daughter, and I want all our troops to join for the celebration. The son of Rana went back and told his father that tonight the general has taken all the guards off of duty and is distracting them all with a party so that we can escape. The Rana escaped. They all escaped from the forest area that night. And soon after that, he met some other man who gave him a huge amount of money to support his rebellion or his insurrection against the Mughal emperor. And he maintained that opposition and for the next 25 years. He had the knowledge, the Rana had the knowledge to know how he should respond to the capture of this general's daughter and wife. And he acted from the psychic. This is his enemy. These are the people who want to kill him. And he did what anybody would normally think was the foolish thing to do, because he gave away the bargaining chip which could save his life and save his whole army, save his kingdom, whatever was left of it. And he said, no. This comes, Ashok's asking about the value of experience. What is the experience this was meant to tell him? The experience this was meant to tell him is to do what is right and honorable is more important and valuable than doing what appears to be in my self-interest, even for my survival. And what happened when he did it? Not only that he was freed by the general and allowed to escape, life came to him with a huge amount of wealth that gave him the freedom to continue his fight for 25 years and never be conquered after that. So this is the knowledge that can come to us when we get away from the ego. We go into the inner being, and we identify with the truths of the inner being. That comes in the story of Dr. Thorne. when his brother has promised to marry a girl and made her pregnant and then had no intention of doing it. He acted very dishonorably. His brother is killed by the girl's brother, Roger. Thorn, not necessary. He offers to take the girl, marry, and treat her as his own daughter. He raises her with great affection. She ends up getting a huge inheritance from Roger, from her uncle, which nobody ever expected that would happen. And after that, Dr. Thorne, who was a very, not very poor, but certainly didn't have any extra money, after doing all of that, he is married to a woman, Miss Dunstable, who's very wealthy. And the reason she wanted to marry him was, he's the only man who's not after me for my money. He's the only man who won't do anything for money. So this knowledge, and there are so many stories of this, wonderful story. This knowledge, when we act from a deeper level, from an inner guide and not from the outer ego's point of view, opens up possibilities and turns negative experience into wonderful experience for our growth, for our spiritual development. So, how does the subliminal know? I said it can know through the subtle senses, the way we know the ego knows through the surface senses, but it can also know directly, by direct contact. There can be a direct emotional contact between ourselves and another person. You concentrate on that person, you identify with them in your feelings or in your thoughts, and there's a direct sense of what's going on in the other person. This is knowledge by direct contact. It's not a perfect knowledge. It's not an infallible knowledge. But compared with the kind of knowledge we have on the surface, it's a very powerful and very high knowledge. But we can go further. From the subliminal, we can expand out and into the cosmic consciousness. We have moved from our surface being to our inner being, but our inner being is also divided from the rest of the universe by a barrier. He says it's not a wall, it's more like a fence. It's something we can move, we can penetrate, it's something we can move beyond. And when we try to do that, we find out that the sense of limits we have, the sense of separateness we have, is not true when we go inside. We are not separate and cut off from everything else. We are not really not self with everything else. Some of you may remember the story that Mother tells, that she was walking in the streets of Paris, lost in a kind of a trance, and when she came to a street corner and started to cross, suddenly she was pushed back, pushed like almost physically back onto the sidewalk, and just then a tram sped by her. And she explained that she was not touched by anything. There was no physical contact. The tram touched her circumconscient being, her subtle envelope, and she felt it at that distance before it touched her physical body, and when it touched her subtle envelope, she jumped back. Because what we think ends with the border of my skin and this is me and everything else is not me is not true. She had consciousness, she had a wider sense of herself. And we can go beyond even that circumconscient envelope to open and identify with the cosmic spirit and feel a oneness with the whole world and feel an opening to the universal energy that's there all around us. so that nothing comes to us as a threat anymore. Everything comes as a movement. Nothing is against us, whether it's a Carolyn or Lady Catherine or Wickham or anything like that. Because even now we see in the story that actually Wickham and Carolyn and Lady Catherine are all working for the larger aim. They only do it through what looks on the surface like a conflict. So, if we have the cosmic consciousness, we have the perception that everything is going on in a certain way inside us, included within us. We can have a direct consciousness of anything that goes on in the world by our trying to relate to that thing. And this is the experience of cosmic consciousness. But he says, this knowledge of the universe does not come with an equal power, because we're still not really identified with our true self. We can have a direct contact with what's going on, a sense of connectedness with what's going on, but we don't yet have the full power over what goes on everywhere. For that, the cosmic consciousness is not sufficient. We need to leave the cosmic consciousness and go to the next station, which is the superconscient, the supermind. And it's there that we go beyond the separative knowledge where I am one thing and you are somebody else. We go beyond even the direct contact with others. We go to the knowledge by identity. And as Ashok's question brings out, when we come to the knowledge by identity, it doesn't mean that we lose all our experience as individual people or all our capacity. We can still sense people outwardly. We can still sense them inwardly. We can still have the direct contact with them. But at the same time, we can have this inner knowledge that at a deeper level, we are all one. So what is this knowledge by identity? What is it we should know? We should know that in the depths of our being, the real truth of our being is that we are a supreme, timeless existence and consciousness. That is the truth of our being. Immortal, eternal, infinite. We can have awareness of that self-existence. We can be conscious that we exist beyond all of the limitations and definitions that we're in now, just the way Jane Austen knows that she lives beyond all the stories and characters that she has portrayed. But something very fundamental happens here. When we know things by identity, we no longer know them because we try to find out something. We no longer look for something or seek something or even try to contact something. We know it because it is us. The same way when you wake up in the morning, you know that you are you and not somebody else. The same way you can know that you're happy because you're identified with that happiness. You would know everything. Everyone, every movement that happens, not only the spiritual truth, but everything that happens in the world as well. The whole world would be included in your consciousness. The whole world would reveal itself. If you want to know, if you want to know whether you're happy, you sense that and you know. If you want to know anything, it would all be there within you, indwelling within you, because you include everything. If you want to know how somebody feels, because you are included in everybody. Simply, you would know. You would know how Lizzie feels, or Darcy feels, or Wickham feels, or any other person. They may not know how you feel, but if you are in the knowledge by identity, you would know because you are one with them at that level. You would know not only what they are on the surface, you would know what they are in the subliminal, you would know what they are, you would know the soul, you would know them spiritually, because at that level you are one with them. They can never exist outside of you. They can never be totally foreign to you. They exist within your consciousness, just like the characters in Jane's story exist within her consciousness. This knowledge by identity doesn't mean that you lose all the other forms of knowledge. It includes them. You not only know you're one with them, you feel everything within you, and you feel that you are in everything else. So he speaks about three experiences of the knowledge by identity: identity or oneness, inclusion, where everything is included within you, and indwelling, where you dwell within everyone else and know them because you are them. So this is the triple knowledge, which is known in the Upanishads. By the shlokas it says, he who sees all existences as the self. This is the first of them. This is knowledge by identity. All existences as the self. He who sees the self in all existences, dwelling in all existences. Yourself, the truth of you, is dwelling in everyone else. The same self is there. And he who, in whom the self has become all existences. This is the inclusion. Everything is within the self because the self has become everything. Jane Austen has become all the characters in her story. Now we have reached the top of the roller coaster, and we only have about 20 minutes left for the rest of the journey, so it's going to be a fast ride going downhill, which is the way it usually is on a roller coaster. Anyway, but the question is, from this, how do we get back to where we were? And how does it explain where we were? How do we leave, if this is the truth of what our consciousness is in the spiritual heights, the identity, inclusion, and indwelling, how do we get to this place where we're locked between two walls and the world outside is not known to us, and even our own true being inside is not known to us? This happens. Now we're going to descend. We're going to descend, and the process of our descent is we're going to begin to lose contact with the fact that everything we know is part of us. We're going to get a separation. This is knowledge by identity. There's no separation. It's not even knowledge by direct contact, because there's no separation to contact. There's nothing to contact. There's nothing away from you. You don't seek something outside. You know it all inside. It's there by identity. But what happens if we begin to forget that identity? Ashok, you wanted to ask something?
Yes, Gary.
Please.
See, I find that even when the desired knowledge has been secured by the person, it's not helpful. I mean, the knowledge is strangely without any power to set right the situation. See, I know some devotees who have developed a diabetic complication. I referred the matter to Appa and said, I told Appa, you see, that person has a very high sugar level and he is taking all kinds of medicines, and all day long he is obsessed with controlling his sugar. Why has this experience come to the person? Appa used to say, it's very simple, the man has lost his job, You must know what kind of insecurity a person should be feeling who has lost his job. I mean, his whole financial scheme has become unstable, and that kind of insecurity can give rise to these kinds of problems. So then I contacted the concerned person and told him, Appa says your sugar is connected to your financial insecurity. Because you have lost your job, you are not sure of your income, and that insecurity has brought about this sugar. The devotee agrees, yes, I feel financially very much insecure, and that could be easily be connected to my sugar disorder. My point here is, even though the person knows that the insecurity is the problem, it doesn't help to correct the sugar problem at all. That stays pretty much strong.
Very good point. It's a very good point. Very good point. Because what is the knowledge he should have? The knowledge is not just that his sugar problem is because of his insecurity. His insecurity itself comes why? What is the source of his insecurity? Because he's identified with his surface ego. If he's a mother's devotee, and he has the whole universal transcendent divine mother there to support him, and he still feels insecure, what does it mean? Why? Because he's not the devotee
I'm talking about.
Mother. Yes, I know, but that's my point. It's a devotee only in the head. It has not become real. It's knowledge. If he really knows the knowledge that Sri Aurobindo's talking about in this chapter, he cannot have insecurity. He would know he's one with the world. He would know that mother is there all around him. He would know that it's because he clings to, not he, all of us, we cling to our narrow, ignorant, the definition of ourselves as somebody between these two narrow borderlines and think the rest of the world is not us. That we can have insecurity. When you have the knowledge that Sri Aurobindo is having, insecurity is something you can never have. So it's not the knowledge, you have taken it too literally. You have said he must know that his insecurity is the cause of his disease. He must know what's the cause of his insecurity. The cause of his insecurity is he's ignorant of the truth of being a mother's devotee. If he simply knows the truth of being a mother's devotee and is fully grateful to mother and fully open to mother and fully relies on mother for all she can give him, he can have no insecurity and he need not have any diabetes. That's the knowledge he needs. That's the reason for the experience. The experience is not coming to him so that he's not having diabetes so that he should know that his diabetes is because of insecurity. I don't know what type of knowledge that is. That's better than ignorance, complete ignorance, I agree. What's the knowledge that's coming from him through the diabetes? That in spite of being mother, devotee of mother, he's not really relating to mother. He's relating to mother outwardly. He's relating to mother in his mind. He may be relating to mother in the thought of his prayer. He's not really letting mother into his life, relying on mother and being a child of mother. And that's why this experience comes to him. The knowledge that we're talking about here is not just an intellectual explanation. The knowledge that Darcy got from Lizzie was not an intellectual explanation, oh, you're a selfish man. The knowledge he got was, I should give up being selfish and self-important. The knowledge he got was not just a mental description, it was an emotional change. The knowledge that he got was, I should give up my arrogant sense of superiority, which is his very body feels that superiority, like Lady Catherine does. The knowledge that Lizzie needed to get is not just to read the letter and know that Wickham's a bad man or a scoundrel, or that you can't rely on somebody just because he's handsome and charming. The knowledge that she was to get was that that attraction that she feels in the depth of her vital, like her mother feels it, like Lydia feels it, is a destructive lower vibration, which is the source of misfortune for her, and she should give it up. She wasn't willing to give it up when she read the note at Hunsford. She did give it up somewhat after that, mentally. But vitally, she still felt attracted to him. That's why when she pleaded with her parents, her father, let Wickham come back to Meryton, to Longbourn with Lydia. She defended him. Even after the elopement, after he's destroyed everything, when she sees him again and knows the truth of everything, see, well, it doesn't mean that your presence is unwelcome, and she holds out her hand so he can kiss it. Something is still, in spite of the man has ruined her life, her whole family, and Darcy saved them, something still is attracted to her. She still doesn't have the full knowledge. That's why she ends up paying money to him for the rest of her life, as far as the story goes. Because knowledge is not an intellectual knowledge only. It has to become a physical reality for her. She made enough progress to get married and become mistress of Pemberley. Darcy didn't mean that he's given up all of his ego and all his self-importance. He made enough progress to win Lizzie. That was real knowledge, but it doesn't mean that he's a totally transformed supermental being. So your point raises a very important question. The knowledge that has power has to be knowledge at the level of the problem. If our problem is mental, then a mental knowledge is enough. The diabetes is physical. It means at the level of the body, we must have this knowledge of mother. Mother must be real to us. We should rely on her at that level. And it comes as a to help us do that. And many devotees, you know that. You have told me so many stories. There are devotees that have had magnificent experiences of mother and her physical power, which they never would have had if they hadn't had a physical ailment. Because as you know, it's much easier to believe mother will help you find the answer to a mental problem, and maybe she can help you find an answer to a problem with other people. But how can she help you even with a physical problem? So the physical problem comes to help us discover the power of mother, even at that least, that inconscient physical level.
Gary, one more confusion that you may hear of. Yeah, I find many devotees praying for relief from their problems. And they do get relief even if they don't understand how the problem has come about in the first place.
Great.
There it looks like the grace doesn't need the person's knowledge of how he has gotten into a problem to bring about a solution.
Correct.
A devotee gets cancer. He doesn't understand how cancer can rise in a body, nor does he understand how medicines counteract the effect of cancer. All he is aware of is the pain of cancer spreading in his body. Now he prays to mother for relief from cancer. So even when he doesn't understand how cancer originates in the body, simply because he prays to the mother, he gets some relief and he becomes healthy again. Now, this leads me to believe that lack of knowledge is not a deterrent in the way of grace acting on a problem. Now I hear a very strange incident in mother's life. She developed gout in the legs, in the toe. That was brought to Sri Aurobindo's notice. Sri Aurobindo did not understand that this disorder is called gout.
He didn't know that she had gout. He knew she had a problem.
Technically, it was not told to him that this disorder is called gout.
It's not the name of the disorder. He didn't know, it's not that he didn't know the name of it. He didn't know that it was gout. He knew she was having certain symptoms.
Now Dr. Sanyal was called to identify the disorder, and as soon as he saw it, he identified it as gout.
Right.
The minute Sri Aurobindo was told that this problem is called gout and it is caused by deposit of uric acid in the toe, a prayer which he himself was making, which didn't work for 1 week, suddenly started working and gave mother the relief.
Right. Right.
On the one hand, you see a devotee praying for relief from cancer, not even knowing how cancer originated in his body. And we see his faith giving him the relief.
Right.
On the other hand, we see mother suffering from gout, and not even Sri Aurobindo's power of prayer giving any result till the technical knowledge is given.
Right. Wonderful.
So how can we reconcile at the same time that knowledge is not a deterrent and that knowledge is a deterrent?
Wonderful. Excellent. Wonderful question. I have a few answers for you. You're taking knowledge to be simply a mental information, which in the case of Sri Aurobindo's example, that's what it is, and we'll come back to that. The devotee who has an illness and doesn't know the reason for that illness, but cures that illness by faith in mother, what does it mean about their knowledge? They have a far, far superior knowledge to the knowledge of a mental explanation of why I have diabetes because I'm insecure, which doesn't work, as you said. What is their knowledge? They have the knowledge that mother can cure what my ailment is. Isn't that a much greater knowledge? Sri Aurobindo says that faith is the soul's knowledge, that the mind, what faith in the mind reflects the soul's knowledge. So the knowledge they have of their ailment is a spiritual knowledge. They have the soul's knowledge. Whatever is wrong with me, mother can cure it. That's what the other example doesn't have. The person who's been told that your diabetes comes from insecurity and that doesn't relieve them is because they have only that little piece of information on the surface, whereas the devotee who is cured by faith without knowing why they got the diabetes or cancer or whatever it is, has the soul's knowledge. This is a mental information. This is a spiritual knowledge in the text. The diabetes comes to help the first person develop real faith and real knowledge in mother, of what mother is at the physical level, which so many devotees have reported. And you have brought and heard so many magnificent stories where they give up even medicine. Where the doctor says, if you give up the medicine, I am not responsible for you. I can't say you will live. And they're healthy because they have faith in mother at that physical level. This is one thing. Before I come to the Sri Aurobindo's part, there's a second part to this. Mother can cure us, does cure so many problems for us without our having the knowledge, and it's not necessary to have that knowledge in order for her to cure us if we have something much more powerful, which is what the faith is. We can never say, I can't solve my problem because I don't know what in me brought the problem. If we can have the depth of faith in mother to know that whatever my problem is and whatever brought it, mother can cure it. But there's an exception there. And that is, when we don't know what brought the problem, like if you don't know why the ant bit you, even if mother can save you and reduce the pain and eliminate the pain, the chances are that an ant or something else will bite you in future because you haven't learned the lesson. If mother has fully protected you, you said you had protection flowers and had prevented the ant from beating you, the chances are you wouldn't have learned any lesson from that experience as you would have gone on saying things that disturbed the manager. The question is, once you know, you have acquired that knowledge that the ant's biting is related to the way you were relating to the manager. It's a great knowledge. It's a valuable knowledge. Even though it didn't immediately relieve you of the pain, you had 10 seconds of pain. But the point is that knowledge sufficient for you not to repeat it again? If you haven't had that knowledge at all, you can understand the chances of your repeating the same behavior again would be greater. Therefore, even the devotee who's cured by faith doesn't have full knowledge, had enough knowledge to be cured, but not enough to guarantee necessarily that no problem of the similar or different proportion will come in again later. If the full knowledge is there, both of the ostensible cause and of the faith in mother, then that type of problem or related problem can never come in future. So you're looking at it rightfully, but it's a partial example. Now we have to go to Sri Aurobindo and mother, which is much more difficult for us to speak about because you're no longer talking about human beings, you're talking about avatars. There are analogies. We can use an analogy when it's convenient for us, but when we get into trouble, we have to realize the limitations of analogy. With that, I will hazard an explanation that is insufficient, and I can't pass judgment on mother and Sri Aurobindo. If mother should get gout with all the knowledge and power she has, it's not a personal problem of her. It's not due to an insufficiency in her consciousness. It's because of the magnitude of the work she's taken up in the world. And if Sri Aurobindo, for Sri Aurobindo, there's not a lack of power. He has all the power that the devotee gets from faith. He has as direct consciousness of his own. But still, to apply that power, he must know where to put it. You may have everything you need. You have a computer, you have all the things you need to communicate with the rest of the world, but you must know where to plug. You may have all the knowledge and all the power you need to communicate anything anywhere in the world, but you still need to know the phone number or the web address in order to do that. What Sri Aurobindo was lacking was that last tenth of a degree of physical knowledge, whereas he had all the spiritual knowledge in the behind. When Appa told the devotee that his diabetes is due to insecurity, he has given him the physical knowledge, but all the rest the devotee has to find through his faith in mother. One of the favorite stories that Appa has told me, you know the story, I mentioned it often. A man went into a shop on one of the market streets in Madras and says, I need some parts for my car. And the man says, what do you need? And he says, I have a horn. I need the rest. What we have, the knowledge, what we call knowledge is the horn. What Sri Aurobindo has is the rest of the car. All he needs is a horn. All he needed from the doctor was a horn, which is all the doctor can give him. The doctor doesn't have the rest of the knowledge and power he has. When we say we need knowledge, we have a horn, And I say, I know the answer. When I means I have the horn, I need the rest. The rest comes from mother.
Okay.
Great. I'm not going to try to complete the roller coaster ride today because we have interesting territory to cover. All the life experience that comes to us, whether it's an ant bite or diabetes or whatever it is, comes as a means for us to discover a secret knowledge, rather, say maybe it'll be better if we use the word he uses, consciousness. For the secret consciousness in us to emerge, which is not just an information, it is the knowledge that is power. All our interactions with other people, and it comes out beautifully in the story, and we've been using the story so wonderfully, it's so helpful, because every interaction with another person, pleasant or unpleasant, is an opportunity for greater consciousness. It's not just the unpleasant ones. We use the unpleasant ones for our examples because they're very dramatic and it's easy to understand. But pleasant ones are also offering us a great opportunity for greater knowledge, for discovering more of our being. Every pleasant interaction with another person, every pleasant moment, is an offering to us to learn something more about ourselves and the other person, and to learn our commonality, our identity, our similarity. Every acquaintance, activity, and event, not just the negative ones, much more so the positive ones if we're capable of that, has that potential. As the dance at Meryton offered to Darcy, as Lizzie hearing the word tolerable, as the vacation holiday in Derbyshire, and even the news of the elopement, every moment has that potential. Consecration is the means for us to move from the surface to the inner being. Knowledge is not what we collect with the mind or read in the books. Knowledge is that which takes us from the surface towards to the inner being, which is where our true being is. Knowledge is not to learn about that other not-self, but to learn that there is no not-self, that everybody is part of us, and we are part of everybody else, and there is the same self in all. All that Appa has talked to us about taking the other person's point of view, feeling goodwill, goodness, self-giving, are practical ways for us to move from this double wall of surface ignorance towards a greater knowledge and consciousness of our own true being, which has the power to make our life more and more mother's life, and more divine. I look forward to seeing you next month, or to meeting you next month.
First, I am giving Gary sir a big thanks, delivering such a speech. Last month, we talked about the experiences. This month, how we have to get the knowledge, not from our mind and ourself. It is from the being that knowledge should we have to get. And how we have, he explains with so many experiences and explanations. And Ashokan sir, questions was very useful for the explanation. And it was very easy to get it. But he has to finish. He is telling that he will complete it next month. He has given some time for us to think what we have to do, and we meet it next month with this same energetic session in Mambalam Center. Now I am giving thanks to everybody, for the devotees and Mother and Sri Aurobindo and Appa and we are closing the session.
Thank you, Vijaya.